being here. Hope everyone's had a profitable day, restful day, whatever your preference is. The lesson this evening is a follow-up to what we were talking about last Sunday morning. I mentioned by way of introduction that the lesson then was largely kind of pointing toward women and their behavior, and that I'd try to kind of even things out in the not too distant future and talk about men. Well, here we are. We're going to talk about men. And the lesson kind of took on a life of its own. Sometimes that's what happens. You're not interested in my process. But lots of times a lesson will just kind of go in a direction I had not intended. And that's where this morning's lesson came from, basically. We just kind of started talking about responsibility in general and not really toward men at all. And so I just kind of let it go, and we did that and then came up with this instead. So what we're going to talk about here this evening is the role of men, and especially with regard to sexual morality, toward temptation, and we'd emphasized before that women have a certain responsibility toward society in general, toward men in particular, and men have responsibility too, and the idea that we can as men kind of write off our failures, our weaknesses, and say, well, it's not my fault after all. The woman just, just taking her clothes off right in front of me. Well, of course I did this and that or something else. And we're going to try not to get too terribly gross about this. But at the same time, be pointed enough for us to appreciate that we as men have a responsibility toward holiness, toward righteousness, toward moral conduct and behavior and thoughts that really doesn't have anything to do with women, doesn't have anything to do with women's choices, with current standards, with current the nature of entertainment and what you happen to see at Walmart and our generation versus previous generations. And it really doesn't have anything to do with any of that. It has to do with whether you as a man are going to be willing to accept the responsibility that's placed on you by God. And if you're struggling with that, thankfully you probably have a woman in your life who will help you with this, and she will be very glad to help you with this, in fact, because the best thing that a woman can have in her life is a man who's worthy of being called a man, and the same thing could be said in reverse. So we're going to talk about what a real man looks like, and from a Bible perspective. And as always, please follow along in your Bible and encourage me to correct my life if I'm not the kind of man that I ought to be in the pulpit or anywhere else. Anyway, what do real men do? There was a kind of a joke back before there were such things as memes, that back when I was growing up, real men do this and real men don't do this and things like that. Well, we're going to talk about what real men do from a Bible perspective. Real men accept responsibility. And this, again, touches on, there's going to be some overlap between what we're talking about here tonight and what we did this morning. Hopefully not too much. But if you're going to be a man, if you're going to be a grown-up, as it were, and a lot of these principles are going to apply to women as well, but we're going to be primarily talking about men. If you're going to be a grown-up, if you're going to be an adult in an adult society, part of that means accepting responsibility. A big part of that involves accepting responsibility. If you have children in your house, or used to have children in your house, or if you can remember back to when you were a child in somebody else's house, you can appreciate that one of the very first things that goes wrong, that happens when something goes wrong in a house with children, children mess up, the milk is spilled or the vase is broken or whatever it happens to be. And the very first thing that happens is the child who is immediately responsible for this starts explaining why it wasn't their fault, right? Why they didn't really mean it. And that's a very common, I didn't mean it, I didn't mean it. And I think that what's going on here, that the average 8-year-old may not be sophisticated enough to realize what's going on, but what's actually going on when this happens is, and grown-ups do this too, if we can convince ourselves that our action was not deliberate, then we should not be held responsible for the consequences of our action. Because the only real crime, the only real sin, is deliberate. And if what I did wasn't deliberate, then I can't be punished for this. I can't be blamed for this. And that's a very handy position to take, because if I can convince myself, and ideally convince other people, that what I did was an exception, as it were, it wasn't deliberate, That means I don't have to change anything. See, I have a certain lifestyle, and it just accidentally happened that such and such broke or was spilled or whatever. It wasn't my fault because, you know, I didn't do it deliberately. And if that's the case, then I can't be blamed, and therefore I don't have to change my behavior. I can continue to be reckless. I can continue to be careless, and nobody can fault me for this. The bottom line is we have to be more responsible than that. And with regard to men getting into positions of temptation and sometimes beyond temptation, with regard to women, you are capable, men, and you know this, you are capable of saying no. And when I say you're capable of saying no, I'm not just saying you're capable of not fornicating, which is true, obviously. You're capable of doing that. But the sin process, I think that we would agree, begins somewhat before the actual act. And I would offer to you from the Bible here that it's not just that you can say no to the actual act. You can say no to sin at any stage in this process. Nobody is going to force you into some kind of sinful behavior or sinful thought process. You have control over this. And this comes up, it really grates on me when I hear, and I've heard this fairly recently, with regard to fornication. Marriage is falling apart, and we're beating up on the men, so let's talk about men. The husband is untrue to his wife, and he's caught, and he confesses, and everything's just going crazy. And people are trying to console him about this, and trying to build him up, and he says, you know, I messed up. There's no question I messed up. And there's always a but, right? You can see the but on the horizon when it's coming. It's just a matter of time. But you don't know what I'm dealing with. You don't understand the kind of, you know, whether it's, you know, deprival or whether it's she's nagging or whatever. There's always some kind of issue going on in the house that pushed me toward this admittedly bad decision, which I shouldn't have done. Not suggesting that I should. That it's okay for me to do it, but. And that's the way people are always, right? Whenever there's an apology that includes the word but, what follows the but is a reason why they're not actually sorry for what they're apologizing for. Have you ever noticed that? That's the way that it tends very strongly to work. Well, and I put this up here, I think it was Tuesday when I was writing this outline here. And I wrote the line here, a husband who blames his wife for his indiscretions is dot, dot, dot. And I said, one of these, you know, at some point before Friday, I'm going to come up with a word that I like sticking in them. Like, and I never did. I could not think of a word. There is not a word in my vocabulary that is repeatable that I'd be willing to put on a slide like this that would adequately explain my contempt for a man like that. That is not a man who does that. You take responsibility for what you have done. And I realize that that comes with consequences lots of times. If you don't blame anybody else, all the blame is yours. And that's a very uncomfortable place to be. I get that. I've been there. Most of us have been there. Not in regard to fornication. Yeah, I haven't been there. But we understand. It's a tough thing. But it's what men do. It's what grown-ups do. In Colossians chapter 3, in verse number 13, it talks about husbands loving their wives, the text says there. And it's a version of what Paul writes in to the Ephesians. But he says in Colossians, husbands, love your wives and do not be embittered against them. That's kind of an interesting phrase there. Do not become embittered against. Do not allow your marriage, as inadequate as it may be, as flawed as your wife may be, do not allow this to get into a place in your mind where you are rationalizing and justifying in your own mind rotten behaviors and rotten attitudes on your own part. And certainly don't put yourself in a position where you go too far and then blame somebody other than yourself. That is not appropriate. That's not what a grown-up is going to do. The book of Titus, especially chapter 2, where he's talking about the old men and the young men and the old women and the young women. Titus likes, or Paul rather, to Titus, likes to use the word sensible. And I like that word. Be sensible. Old men, you're supposed to be sensible. Young men, on the other hand, are supposed to be sensible. It applies to everybody here. And sensible, in the English anyway, looks a lot like the word sensual because it kind of derived from the same root in the English. I don't know about the Greek, but in English anyway, the idea of sense is a complicated kind of thing. When we're talking about being sensible, we're talking about common sense. We're talking about your intelligence, your wisdom, being able to make good decisions on the spot. That's what we need to train ourselves to do. And older men can ideally train the younger men how to do a better job of it. And maybe vice versa as well. The word sensual, although similar in the English, is very different. When we're talking about sensual beings, we're talking about sensual decisions. We're talking about decisions that have to do with the five senses. That have to do with fleshly things. Not sinful things necessarily, but things that pertain to what you see, what you touch, what you hear, what you smell, what you taste. And the people of the world who do not necessarily have any regard for spiritual things are obsessed with sensual things, as you would expect they would be. They are kind of eaten up with what affects the senses, and then the better it affects the senses, the better they like it. And that's fine as far as it goes. But sometimes we, as people of faith, as people who trust the Bible, who understand there's more important things than simply those things that meet the senses, we realize that occasionally you need to do something that is contrary to your sensual appetites. And a lot of very ungodly people understand this. This is not a bizarre church thing. We appreciate this. Most of us in our culture, at least at some level, appreciate that sometimes you may need to make a good decision instead of making a fun decision. And that's what we need to be prepared to do. Galatians chapter 5 and verse number 19, among the works of the flesh, or the deeds of the flesh that he mentions there. Verse number 19, one of the things that he mentions there is sensuality. Among immorality and impurity and sensuality. That's kind of a theme there. We'll talk about immorality or fornication, some versions have there. That's the act itself. Impurity, that's the values inside of your mind that push you in that direction. And then there's the priorities that feed those values. The sensual attitude that you may have that pushes you toward merely physical things. Excuse me. We need, as men, as grown-ups, as adults, to be able to appreciate sensible things, including when they run contrary to what our sensual appetites might be pushing us toward. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse number 12, talks about how we are not to be enslaved, even to legal things. I'm not going to be bound, I'm not going to be enslaved or addicted, depending on your translation, to anything, he says, even to lawful things. And in 1 Corinthians, he talks a lot about things that are not necessarily sinful in and of themselves, but that become sinful because of context, because of the situation, because of their dealings with other people. Chapter 9 particularly emphasizes how we give up certain things that may not necessarily be bad things in and of themselves, but they become bad things because they're interfering with a bigger process, with a more noble process. Our responsibility toward our brethren, toward women, toward God, this is bigger than what is not that bad in my mind or in your mind. So what we need to do is, and the best way to not be addicted to something, by the way, is not try it. This is the conversation that we have with the young people with regard to alcohol and tobacco and marijuana and things like that. If you don't go down the road, you don't get stuck on that road. That kind of makes sense. Well, it works the same way with regard to sex and with regard to sexual promiscuity and that sort of behavior here. The less emphasis you place on it in the first place, when it doesn't really seem all that dangerous, the less likely it is that you get to the place that actually is dangerous. You know, it's a dangerous world out there on the best of circumstances. We certainly ought to be setting ourselves up for success rather than setting ourselves up for failure. Set up boundaries and respect them. Job mentions this. Job 31, verse number 1, he talks about how I have made a covenant with my eyes not to look upon a virgin, not to look upon a young woman. If I've made a covenant with my eyes, I've made a deal, he says. And now I'm not going to go back on that. Well, what's the point in making a deal if you're going to go back on it after all? Well, his advice is good advice for us. And I talk a lot about drawing lines and things of that nature. There are a lot of behaviors with regard to men and women things, with regard to other issues that come up in life that aren't necessarily black and white issues. But we know if we stay on this side of this particular line, we're going to be okay. So you draw the line, make it nice and firm, nice and dark, nice and thick, where you can understand where it is, and then you don't cross that line. And now you don't have to worry anymore about whether it's okay or whether it's not really that big of a deal or whether other people are doing it or whether you got permission from the elders, from the preacher, your parents or whatever. None of that matters anymore. Because you've drawn a line. You've made a contract with your eyes. You made a contract with your behavior. And now all you have to do is be true to your commitment. And that keeps you out of trouble. And that's a great habit to get into with regard to the movies that you watch or the TV shows that you watch or your behavior with regard to the opposite sex. There's nothing wrong with having lunch with somebody of the opposite sex at the office. You know, somebody that you enjoy keeping company with. You know, maybe she's married, maybe you're married, but nothing's happening, nothing's going on here. We all realize that. Well, there have been many, many, and maybe you know some examples of marriages that fell apart because of exactly that kind of situation. Well, if you don't have the lunch, you don't get the divorce. Well, don't you think that's kind of an overreaction? Don't you think it's kind of overstepping? I don't know. Maybe. What difference does it make? I'm going to go to heaven saying, boy, this is great, God. Thanks a lot for this. But, looking back, I really wish I'd had more lunches with women of the opposite sex. I just don't think that's that big of a deal. Isn't that something that we can sacrifice in quest of a godly marriage and a godly conscience? We set up a boundary that we refuse to violate. And the more bad choices that you have to make before giving in to your temptations and committing the big sins, you might say, the better. And fornication is such a great example of this. I'm constantly amazed at this. I see that Christians commit fornication. They cheat on their spouse. They have sex before marriage or whatever. They commit these sins. I couldn't help myself. I just got caught up in the moment. It's not about the moment. Appreciate this. And think if you haven't ever done this before, think about how many bad decisions you have to make to have sex out of wedlock. Think about how many. I mean, we're talking about dozens of things at various lynch points in your relationship with this person. Here you're just, two people who know each other, and over here you're having people who have an affair. And between those two points, there's all kinds of different stopping points. Maybe a dozen of them, maybe more. You're overly complimentary, and then maybe you're overly candid with somebody. You confess something, some private secret about your wife to them when you shouldn't. And before too long, you're spending time in private. You're having close, intimate conversations. And then you're having conversations that you're not telling your wife about, and she's not telling the husband about. And before too long, you're meeting in some kind of... And eventually alcohol gets involved in this. Usually alcohol is involved, because that makes it a lot easier. And just one decision after... And realize that in this, say, a dozen different decisions that you make here, at any point in this process, at any point, you can completely and totally and permanently derail this process and not get to this end by simply doing nothing. You don't have to make a good decision. You just have to avoid making a bad decision. That's all you have to do. I assure you, if the woman makes her intentions clear about having an affair or whatever, and you sit there and you just kind of stare at her like a sheep or something for 5 minutes, that opportunity is going to close. She's going to pack up and go away. You don't have to say, I really respect you as a human being, but I think we've gone too far, and I think that my marriage is important. You don't have to have that conversation. It'd be better if you did, and you ought to have had it, frankly, earlier than that. But you don't have to. All you have to do is do nothing, and your pants will remain zipped. It's astounding how, and yet we make bad decisions. If you can set yourself up where a multiple, not just a dozen, maybe two dozen bad choices have to be made, you multiply your chances for staying on the right side of morality. Now, the one who refuses to do this, and I'm going to be brutally honest about this, and if you take offense at this, I'm sorry, but I'm not sorry. Please don't take offense at this, but take the instruction as it's intended. If you refuse to accept this responsibility, if you say, I would rather just kind of live my life on my own terms and do what I want to do and trust somehow that it's going to work out okay and not talk to the preacher about this, not talk to the elders about this, not talk to my wife about this. If that's the attitude that you choose to maintain, I humbly but firmly submit to you that you are a child and you are not a man. Grown-ups realize the wisdom in this. Not because I said it or because I said it so well, but because the Bible said it. And because it's right and because we all know it's right. So we need to grow up. We need to be adults about this. Be real men. Real men accept reality. Point number two. There are situations that we would like to exist. There is a world that we would like to live in. And there's the world we actually live in. And those two things are not necessarily the same. In fact, for Christians, we know they're not the same because we would like to live in heaven and we are living here. So there's obviously no overlap there. But even in this world, even as we live in the flesh, there are certain aspects to life on planet Earth that could be better and that maybe even were better in some ways. And that we would like to pretend are not, in fact, as bad as they actually are. And I would submit to you here that your life is not going to get any better by denying reality. It's much better for you to accept and deal with the situation that you have in front of you rather than pretending that it is something else. Now, here's what the reality is. This is what the real world is. And I kind of accidentally made some of this point this morning, and I'll try not to over make it again here. Reality is, you have constraints placed on you by God, especially in marriage. God lays down marriage law. In Matthew chapter 19, you know the text pretty well. I don't feel any need to go back over that again. But essentially what he is saying there is that when God has joined you together, man is not supposed to separate this. This is a godly marriage. It needs to stay a marriage. And the one who breaks this marriage is in sin. And the one who continues on and marries another after this sin is committing adultery. Because in God's eyes, he is still bound to the previous wife or the previous husband. And so therefore, this is what God teaches. Now, I realize that that's not what modern society teaches. That's not what a lot of people who call themselves Christians teach in the modern day. I can't help that. I'm going to live in the reality. You know, the reality that we're living in. The reality is that people are doing that. I wish they weren't, but they are. We need to accept the reality of what the Bible teaches on this subject rather than what we wish the Bible taught on the subject, rather than what we hear other people teaching on the subject, rather than what the elders may say or what the current self-help guru may say at the bookstore or whatever, some knucklehead on TV, whoever it happens to be that we're listening to, instead of God. Always accept what God's instructions are. Now, there are certain instructions for single people. There are certain instructions for married people. There are certain instructions for divorced people. And if you're going to accept what God has to say, then you can find a way to prosper in that state, whatever it happens to be. And if you can't do that, if you can't move into a different state and still please God, you need to not move into that state. If you're a single person that's not permitted to be married, if you're a married person that's not permitted to be single, if you are a married person not allowed to be divorced, if you're a divorced person that's not allowed to be single, whatever it happens to be. A divorced person not allowed to be married would be a better way of phrasing that, sorry. If you are in a current state and you would like to be in this other state, but God doesn't let you be in that state, you find a way to be content and satisfied and serve God where you are, rather than ignoring what God says on this subject. If you can't accept the instructions that God has for a particular state, don't enter that state. And that's part of what the apostles say there at the end of this, around verse 11 and 12, where the apostles are just astonished at Jesus' strict teachings on divorce. Well, maybe it's better not to get married at all. And Jesus says, maybe not. If you can't listen to instructions for marriage, then don't get married. I used to tell young men, especially, women take care of this themselves. They don't need any help. But the men particularly, the average 21, 22, 23, you need to get yourself married. You know, that's because your life is a mess. And I know very, very few exceptions, including this one, to this. It's men on their own just don't do very well. Yeah, and they do a lot better when they're married. And so therefore, you know, if you go ahead and get married, maybe you can start growing into an actual human being. And I've quit saying that. I don't say that anymore. And this is why. Because there are plenty of men who realize that their life is kind of in a shambles and that in some ways at least it would get better if they got married. And so they get into marriage and they don't know what they're doing. And more than they don't know what they're doing, they're not really committed to the process. They're not really committed to the woman. They're not really committed to marriage. They're not really committed to the Bible. And as such, they enter into this completely foreign state, and they get blown away. They're not used to it. They find out that they can't watch whatever TV show they want. They can't have whatever they want for dinner. That the wife sometimes is not in the mood to do, you know, housework or whatever it is that he bargained on her doing all this time. And I'm going to quit. He's not ready for marriage. Well, you get into this state of marriage after you are mentally prepared, at least to try to adopt these principles. Accept what God has to say. If you're getting into marriage, and, well, you know, I'm not going to get divorced. But bottom line is, you know, people get divorced. Christians get divorced. And if it doesn't work out between me and her, which, you know, we have every confidence it's going to. But if it doesn't, you know, as long as we have that. If you allow yourself that fallback position, you will avail yourself of that fallback position. That's the way that it works over and over and over again. Be constrained by God's law. The world will appeal to your weakness. We talked about Proverbs chapter 9 and this woman of folly, the woman of, she's called a foreign woman or a boisterous woman, depending on your translation. And she is a recurring character in the book of Proverbs, especially the first part of it. She is this woman who is determined to drag this young man into the sewer with her. And they're going to have a lot of fun on the way. But in the end, he's going to destroy himself over this woman. And the writer here, Solomon, is trying to encourage his young reader to make a better decision, to seek after wisdom instead of the folly that this woman presents here. This is the way the world is going to be. All right, now, if you thought that, you know, this is the Bible Belt, or more or less the Bible Belt anyway. And, you know, surely if I were living here in this area, the women are going to be, you know, more high-minded, and the men are going to be more high-minded, and we're not going to have to worry about all this impropriety and bad. That's not the way. I didn't really have that in my mind when I moved here. And, you know, Texas has that reputation too, and I know it's not true, and I figured it wasn't true here either, and it's not. It's true for some people, but not for everybody, not by any means. For everybody, or even most people. When we and by the way, in our society, as long as you have a, you know, an internet hookup or a, you know, Sling TV or whatever it is that you're getting your TV from these days, it doesn't matter where you're living. You can be living in Point Barrow, Alaska, and you haven't seen a person in 6 months, and it doesn't matter. You can still be exposed to all this stuff through the internet and all the rest of this stuff. The world is going to appeal to you, to your weaknesses. And the more you appreciate this, and the more you appreciate what your weaknesses are, the better you're going to be in position to stave these things off. You are capable of choosing better than this woman. Proverbs chapter 9 begins earlier in that context. We read the kind of the middle section there. I'd like to refer you briefly to the first section. Because there's another woman in this story. The woman of folly is the one we talk about a lot, but wisdom is personified in this context also. She's also a woman, and she's wooing this young man's attention too. She is trying to get him to follow after her, and she uses very different tactics than the woman of folly does. But she has her appeals as well. The text says in verse number 1, wisdom has built her house, she has hewn out her 7 pillars, she's prepared her food, she has mixed her wine, she's also set her table, she's sent out her maidens, she calls from the tops of the heights of the city, whoever's naive, let him turn in here. So far it sounds kind of like the woman of folly's call. Naive guys, come over here. I have something for you. But to him who lacks understanding, she says, come, eat of my food and drink of the wine that I mix. Forsake your folly and live and proceed in the way of understanding. So she appeals to his mind. She says, I'm going to make you a better person if you come over here and share this life with me. And this is ultimately the decision that young men have to make. And not just young men, but in the context of Proverbs, it's young men. You get to choose what you're going to do with your life. Which woman do you want to marry? Do you want to marry folly, or do you want to marry wisdom? You get to choose. And you can make the right decision here instead of making the wrong decision. Now, you're going to have to control your emotions if you're going to do that. And again, I emphasize, you are capable of doing this. You can, and you should, and you are required to control your emotions. I realize that we get carried away with our emotions sometimes, especially the negative ones. I realize that. We all do. That doesn't mean it's okay. That doesn't mean we didn't have a choice in the matter. We do have choices. Be angry and sin not, the text says in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 26. You can, no matter what your state, No matter how angry you are, no matter how sad you are, no matter how depressed you are, no matter how indignant you are, no matter how resentful you are, or on the other side of the spectrum, no matter how happy or excited or thrilled or carried away with yourself with joy and exultation, all that, no matter what your emotion is, you can choose to not allow that emotion to take you into sinful state. It's just a matter of will. It's a matter of do you want to do that? Now, it gets to a point, kind of the Joseph point, maybe you might call it, where we feel like, rightly or wrongly, we feel like we are incapable of controlling ourselves. That there is a situation that I am in. There is a place where I am. Where in this place, these stimuli that are bombarding me are so powerful and so seductive that they are pulling me almost seemingly without my will into this wrong direction. And if that is the case, if you find yourself in that place, my very strong advice is move. You know, if you have to leave your garment behind, leave it behind. Just like Joseph. I'm in bad place here. Bad things are going to happen to me here. I'm going to go someplace else. It may be a disaster. It may be awful. I may just wreck my day. I may wreck my friendship. I may just have a horrible, horrible time. But it's better than sin. And if I stay here, I'm going to sin. So I'm not going to stay here. I'm going to do something else. You are capable of making that move. Again, it's not a matter of, and I'm not telling you anything that you don't know, fellas. Anything you haven't been told by your parents or your grandparents or other preachers. You are capable of doing this. It's a matter of whether you are willing to do it. Whether you're willing to deny yourself, whether you're willing to take control of your situation, blame yourself instead of blaming your surroundings, like we're talking about this morning. And, not to belabor the point, grow up. And if you're not willing to do this, if you think this is too tough, if it's too hard for you to make good decisions instead of bad decisions, frankly, you sound a lot like a child. That's what children think. That's true for children. We expect that out of 4- and 5-year-olds. We're not surprised at that necessarily with 11- and 12-year-olds. But we're not talking about 11- and 12-year-olds here. We're talking about people in their 20s, people in their 40s, people in their 60s who are fully capable of making good decisions instead of bad decisions and choose to make the bad decisions and make excuses for themselves instead. We need to do better than that. We must do better than that. But it's going to be hard. And that brings us to the third point here. Real men work hard. Now, this is one of those topics that's not necessarily a lot of fun for the teenagers. Because, you know, the teenagers watch a lot of Star Trek and, you know, other kind of futuristic type things. And we've gotten it into our heads somehow that work is a bad thing. And that in an ideal environment, maybe sometime in the future, maybe in our lifetime, we will get to a point where we don't have to work. I hope and pray we do not get to that point. It would be an absolute disaster, but that's another issue. This notion that we have that somehow or another work is something to be avoided, a work is something to be marginalized. And as soon as you can quit working, what a wonderful thing that is. Now, if you want to retire when you're 28, that's your business. I'm not telling you not to. If you can afford to do that, more power to you. Some people do that. That's fine. I hope you find something productive to do with your day, though, after you've retired. And those people in their 60s and 70s who have retired know what I'm talking about here. You know, it's not working is very quickly produced in the lives of good people by working. Maybe not getting paid for it, but working nevertheless. Because you realize that I need to do something with my day. I need to do something productive with my day. And the reason that happens is because you spent 40 years of your life working. And not only have you come to realize that work is not going to kill you, you've gotten to a point where you realize work is good for me. It's good for my family. It's good for my relationships. It's noble. It's why God told Adam and Eve to work in the very beginning. Why he continues to tell us to work. Work is necessary. And hard work sometimes is going to be necessary also. With regard to temptation, sometimes staying away from sin is going to be hard. It's going to be really hard. It's going to be the hardest thing you've ever done. And for some people, that means it's okay to just not do it. It's okay to quit. It's too hard for me to stay away from sin. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and sin, and then I'm going to say I'm sorry afterward. I'm going to apologize to the wife. I'm going to apologize to the kids. I'm going to apologize to God or whatever. We can and must do better than that. We need to deny the flesh. We were talking about the deeds of the flesh earlier. Paul wraps up the consideration of such things in Galatians chapter 5, verse number 24, after talking about the deeds of the flesh and the works of the fruit of the Spirit, in verse 22 and 23. And he says in verse 24, "Now those who belong to Christ Jesus have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires." Now that's a concept there. It kind of comes across like saying, when you gave yourself to Jesus, you quit wanting to sin. In a sense, that's true. In a sense, that's impossible. And you and I know that. When we came to Jesus, it's because we wanted to live a better kind of life. It's because we wanted to choose good things instead of bad things. And Jesus was going to help us with that. And he was going to forgive us of all the bad choices we'd already made, as well as the bad choices that, unfortunately, we may continue to make. We wanted that from him. And part of the bargain was this notion of repentance. Turning away from sin, accepting a different lifestyle to replace the one that we're abandoning. He calls it here crucifying the flesh. And that sounds kind of brutal. It sounds kind of painful, quite frankly. And it is sometimes. There are times when putting aside the deeds of the flesh is like cutting off an arm. It is awful. It is the most difficult thing you can possibly imagine. But we do it. We have to do it. Because denying the flesh is what being a Christian is all about. You are capable of doing this. Now there may be some ask. I don't know the private life of your in your personal families. The hidden cameras aren't hooked up yet, so I don't have access yet to what's going on in your lives. But we realize that no matter where we are, no matter male or female, there are certain things that draw us into the web of Satan that seem in the moment to be irresistible. And I want to tell you that they are not. They are resistible. It's just a matter of trying a little bit harder than we're trying right now. Or maybe trying a lot harder than we are. Nobody said this was going to be easy. In fact, the implication is it's not going to be easy. Our experience tells us it's not going to be easy. But you can and you must do it. That's what being a Christian is all about. Turning away from bad things, turning toward good things. Real men work hard at serving their wives as well. And I'm not talking about remembering the anniversary and remembering the birthday and things like that. Although if you don't do those things, we might need to have a different conversation. That's not really the point, though. When we are told as husbands to love our wives, Ephesians 5, verse 25, love our wives, he elaborates, well, what exactly does that mean? You know, my wife asked me if I loved her, and I said yes, and so we got married, and there we go. Well, listen to what Paul says about loving your wife, what it looks like. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her, so that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she would be holy and blameless. Now, there may be some husbands here who are really excited about the idea of having a wife that's holy and blameless. And somehow or another, we can get a perfect wife if we just kind of, play our cards exactly right. That's not really the point that Paul is trying to make here with regard to behavior. He's not talking about getting the wife where she ought to be. It's talking about getting you where you ought to be. Developing your love, developing your own attachment. And if you have questions about what loving your wife is like, look at how Jesus loved the church. And then do that. And before too long, you're going to be very, very intimidated. You're going to be kind of scared, in fact. What have I gotten myself into? And you start looking at the things that Jesus did for the church, and you realize, I have to do that for her? I can't do that. Yes, you can. You are capable. And now, after the marriage, you're obligated. So, there's no point in whining about it. Get some help if you need it. From professionals, from elders, from the preacher, from other married people, whatever. Especially get help from the wife. I assure you, she is more than willing to help. She would love to help. Whatever we have to do, though, to serve, to do it better, and women have an advantage here. Sorry, ladies, I don't mean to
you know, let you off the hook here, but women are just better at this than men are. It's just not in our instinct to serve people, to put other people first. You know, we're better at pushing forward and setting goals and achieving them and opening pickle jars, and you know, that's our good. We like to play to our strengths, and this is not a strength for us. But we need to do it anyway. We need to find a way to learn how to serve. And if, by the way, you do want the perfect wife, all of us want the perfect wife, and unfortunately you guys missed out, because I already got her. But if you want the perfect wife, if you want to get in that zone, the best thing that you can do, and ultimately really the only thing that you can do, is love her. If you will love her the way Jesus loved the church, the way that you know you are supposed to love your wife, the way that you are not inclined to love your wife, because it's work, it's hard, it means denying yourself, it means giving up the remote control every once in a while. Yes, it's hard, but you do it. You find a way to do it because it's important. I assure you, if you show that kind of love to your wife will respond to you. It will be good for everybody involved. I promise you that. Thirdly, be an example. Example to your kids, example to your wife, example to your neighbors, whatever. It's not easy for us to hold ourselves accountable at that level. Especially when we're alone, by ourselves, and it doesn't look like anybody's watching. You realize, of course, that things that you do in private have a bearing on your character. In fact, there may be the best reflection of your character. And your character is not just what you are in private. Your character is what you are all the time. And so, therefore, by forming your character in your moments of privacy and allowing yourself sin, you corrupt your character that you're going to take out there into the world, take to your wife, take to your children, take to your neighbors, take to church. You become less of a man by doing this. And so therefore we need to be an example at all times. An example of what? Well, Jesus calls it foot washing. Or at least his example is foot washing. In John chapter 13 and verse number 12 and following, you know the story there. The night before Jesus' betrayal, or the night of Jesus' betrayal, he washes the feet of the disciples. And he asks them in verse number 12, "Do you know what I've done to you? Do you understand this? Do you understand the concept of your master stooping and washing you?" He says, "You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I then, the Lord and the teacher, washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I gave you an example that you should do as I did to you." I regret that so much of our time is spent in this context arguing about whether foot washing is actually a cultural kind of thing or it's some kind of mandatory requirement that's placed on us by God. Most of the time we discuss culture and we convince ourselves that in fact foot washing is local, foot washing is a function of the times and such, and you are not in fact required to grab your wife's feet or your neighbor's feet or whatever and wash them off, and that you can go to heaven without doing that. And we kind of wipe our brow off because we didn't really want to do that. And we get about our life like we haven't learned anything here. And regardless of how you look at foot washing, regardless of how you view the need for this kind of thing, clearly, Jesus is placing an obligation on his people. And if you can't learn to serve in your marriage, I shudder to think if you are ever going to be able to learn to serve anybody. Because you're never going to have a better opportunity. This is the ideal opportunity for you to serve. For you to put somebody else's will, somebody else's priority, somebody else's comfort above your own. By working in that area, by showing your wife how much you care, that you're willing to serve, you might actually encourage her to serve too. You might encourage your children. You might encourage your neighbors, your brethren. If you will raise the bar and work harder, How much am I supposed to serve? What's the obligation here? I'm serving at this level right now, and I figure that's pretty good. Do you think that's okay? No, I don't. And neither does God. Why isn't that okay? Because you can go here. You can serve better. Okay, well, I'll go along. I'll go ahead and serve here. And that'll be okay because the preacher said it was okay. No, that's not okay because you can go here.
There's always more. There's always better. There's always deeper. And we need to be striving to serve better than we are serving. I'm talking about this man here, talking about all the other men, talking about the women too, really. All of us have opportunity and ability and therefore obligation to serve better than we are serving. And again, I think you will find this is, in a twisted, backhanded kind of way, a self-serving way of doing it. Because if you will live your life of service toward the people who are closest to you, you're going to inspire in them an attitude of service. It's kind of a natural thing. It doesn't always work this way, unfortunately, but most of the time it does. Especially if you're talking about Christians. If you will commit yourself to service, if you will raise the bar, saying, this is what service looks like as far as I'm concerned. This is my idea of service. That gets rather intimidating and challenging and inspiring to the people in your zone, especially your wife. When we tell ourselves that we are going to be imitators of Christ, as Paul says a couple of times in 1 Corinthians, by being imitators of Christ, we encourage other people to imitate us. And then greater glory is given not to us, but to the Lord, because we are serving the way Jesus served, for the reason that Jesus served. And we're trying to serve as well as he served. We're falling short, but we're working on that. And the higher our effort level goes, the more we encourage other people to serve as well. And before too long, we have created this community in our marriage, in our family, in the church, that is kind of this upward spiral where we're getting closer and closer to what Jesus wants us to be as individuals, as families, as a society of believers. And again, if you're not willing to do this, if you reject the notion of hard work, you're just not going to make a very good grown-up. And you know, again, sorry, young people, if I'm disillusioning you here, if you have this notion that somehow you're going to be spending 25 hours a week, you know, sitting around twiddling your thumbs behind the desk at AT&T, and that's going to be somehow give you a $100,000 salary, and you're going to be happy as a clam, and all. The world doesn't generally work like that, not generally, and marriage certainly doesn't work that way. But if you will work, if you will commit yourself to work, if you will grow up and accept the responsibility that God has placed on you, you can turn a failure into a success. You can assure yourself, give you every reasonable expectation of growing in your relationship, growing in your service, growing in your family, growing in your faith, because you realize that every step you're taking is based on the direction that God has given you in his word. And therefore, you're becoming more like Jesus. You're becoming more like your wife wants you to be. Good things happen when you make decisions like that. So I urge you, and you know, there are plenty of 45-year-old teenagers out there in the world who have never understood what it is to be an adult. And if they didn't know Jesus Christ, we kind of understand how that works sometimes. Because it's a very tempting thing to revert back into childhood. There are a lot of positive things about childhood. But if you're a person of faith, if you believe in God, if you believe in the Bible, if you're trying to serve like Jesus Christ, you realize that better things are available to you in adulthood. They're not going to be easy. They're not going to be comfortable. But your life is going to be better having adopted them. So do whatever you have to do. Make whatever kind of change. Make it whatever kind of commitment that you have to make to get where you need to be so that you can be the man that God wants you to be. We're going to offer you an opportunity to respond to the Lord's invitation this evening. If you have not been measuring up to God's standard, whether you were measuring up to my standard or not, what difference does that make? But if you haven't been measuring up to God's standard, and you know that, there may be something that we can do as a community of believers to help you with that. We may be able to help you into the water of baptism if you haven't had your sins washed away. We may be able to hear your confession of fault and ask for God's forgiveness on your behalf. We'll be more than eager to do that. Whatever your need happens to be, though, take responsibility for where you are in your life and do whatever you have to do, private or public, to bridge the gap, maybe even the growing gap, between you and your Lord, between you and the service that you know you owe your Lord. Whatever we can do to help with regard to such things, please respond to the invitation while we stand and sing.